Stand. Episode 3, Blank Page, is over, but we're just getting started here on Post Show Recaps. And we have a great episode to tell you all about. There's so many new people we've met. It's almost as if they are like a long list of characters, and we have one blank space left, and I'll write your name, Rob Sestrinino.
Yes.
How about that?
Yes. Okay, let me get out my panchette game and jot down my notes real quick. Yes. The Stand.
Yes. The Stand. Here we are. We are still standing. We are back for a third round after reception has again been pretty positive. Mm-hmm. People seem to want to hear us keep talking about this.
Not as
they
positive as the first one. That I may not come back for week 4.
Oh boy. So again, we crave the attention. We're going to need people to come back.
Yeah, don't take your eye off the ball, people.
Right. We crave validation, basically.
Yes.
And we will, yeah.
Yes.
Come into our magical drawing planchette and tell us what you thought of this episode, what you think of us, or you could even just drop it in our DMs or add us on Twitter. Any of those ways is perfectly fine way, but we need to know you're out there.
Yes. We want to know that we're not just screaming into the void.
No, it's never good to scream into the void. Well, sometimes it is, but that was all, you know, I did a lot more screaming into the void in 2020, I feel like. So far.
The void was bottomless. Yes.
Yeah. So far this year, haven't needed the void yet.
Yes. Just Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, Rob.
Yes.
As of the recording of this, it's January 1st, and we have turned over a new blank page.
Yes.
Much like the blank page that titles the episode. And this episode, I think it's finally settled into its groove.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm on board with the storytelling.
Yeah, I would say I think I liked the last episode a little bit better than this one. This one felt like to me like a little bit more of like a peace mover episode where mm-hmm. we got the introduction and the backstory of like a few more of our main characters, where I feel like that last week was a little bit more of like a showcase for Larry Underwood. But still good. Still like it.
Still good. I realized the problem that this Lost style storytelling runs into after a certain point, and that is that not every role is equal. Some parts are bigger than others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are no small parts, only small actors, but there are some people that we, by design, know a lot less about, and it's just going to get diminishing returns if we front load every single important person. And then we're starting to get to like the B list here. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have more stories coming in and more smaller characters. And I think, you know, with Lost, it was like every character was as big as they needed to be. You could just bring someone in, you'd find out way more about them. But with The Stand, we're going in a direction. We know what direction that is. And we know what role everybody plays. So it's like, are we going to, I was really worried that maybe next week we were just going to get a whole episode of like half of it is Ralph / Ray and the other half is Trash Can Man. We don't need a whole episode of that. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've kind of woven in like exactly as much as we need to know of these characters, but also furthered the story of everybody else. And I'm okay with it. I think it's really starting to, the veneer is starting to come off here of the storytelling style and the reasons why we didn't just do it like this in the first place in the book or the original miniseries. They're starting to show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I did appreciate getting to meet some of these characters and getting to know a little bit more about them, because some of these characters are not the same characters that we know from other adaptations of this work. So I like that very much. And I like the characters we got to meet. I think we're going to have a lot to dig in here. So I'm not sure where you want to start, Rob.
So I feel like that we have to start with Nadine, who...
Yeah, I think you're right.
It was interesting that we got her introduction as a character last week, but didn't really get any of her backstory. So I thought that was interesting in terms of the way that like they gave us any of Nadine at all last week, where she was just sort of like presented as the motherly figure to Joe And then we got the whole backstory of like, oh yeah, she's also betrothed to the Dark Man.
Yeah, and this, I thought this was, this Nadine is maybe the best Nadine we've ever had. Because she is complicated, and one overarching thing that I think we're, this series is giving us that the previous adaptation didn't, and the book definitely didn't. Everybody is getting a choice.
Yeah.
Everybody gets to decide. And Nadine was kind of portrayed as kind of, this was her destiny and she's totally on board with it. But I think everybody, and I think when we get to talking about Nick, we have this as well. There's a real duality to it that for every individual person, like Nadine is also not living her entire life to go to Flag. Like she's got other stuff going on, which I also very much appreciated because she really kind of didn't.
Yeah.
In either the book or the miniseries, she's just like, oh, I'm just going to wait around twiddling my thumbs and, you know, exuding virginity until I get to go be with Flag. And here it's like, we didn't know necessarily that Flag was even a part of her identity in this major way, because we know she's a teacher. We know she's working with Joe. We know that she, you know, she made the trek over with Larry. She kind of likes Larry, but they're not like, you know, they're not romantically involved at this point, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. Jess, could you give us the backstory on Nadine in the novel? I remember, you know, I watched the 94 miniseries, and so that she ends up, of course, that she takes the place of the Heather Graham character in the 94 miniseries. She and Larry are romantically involved. She walks away from Larry. She abandons him because that she is going to ultimately that she's too attracted to him. They play it up in the 94 miniseries. And then Larry meets somebody else and then ends up that she seems like that she comes back to Larry. She's like, I don't want to go through with this. So she seems like that she is not necessarily that she is wanting to go with Flag. And then when she is rejected by Larry, she's like, well, I guess I have no other option than I have to go with Flag. So I would just love to get like the backstory in terms of like how much agency did novel Nadine have?
Well, novel Nadine was kind of like ruled by her sexuality. And one interesting thing that I note is that the scene with the planchette, when she is a younger person, where Flag kind of reaches out to her pre-pandemic, is in the novel to some degree, but she is much older at this point. Mm-hmm. And I think she's in college in the dorm and they're like screwing around with a Ouija board, which I recognize why they changed the Ouija board, because Ouija boards are not very interesting to watch in action. But she is mostly, we meet her, like the youngest we ever see her is in college. And much is made of the fact that she is a virgin. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't even know if we ever know what she does for a living, but you know, we sure know that she never had sex with anybody. And it's kind of hammered home a lot that, you know, she's saving herself for Flag, and she kind of always knew she was saving herself for something. She didn't know what. And she reaches the ripe old age of 27 and people think it's weird, but she has these dreams about Flag and they're like very sexy dreams. And so she's like, well, I probably got to go have sexy time with this guy eventually. And then it is very much what we see here, that she is kind of deploys her attractiveness to seduce Harold into helping her with her evil schemes. But she's really not ever, she likes Larry. She's drawn to Larry. She sees the appeal of being with Larry, but I don't know that in the book it is ever as strongly implied that she makes the conscious decision to try to go back to Larry and gets rejected. I mean, I have not read the book in a while, but that's my recollection, is that Larry is pretty secure. Like they have romantic feelings for each other, but then he meets someone else and it is fine.
Yeah.
I love that we are dispensing with a lot of this romanticness mm-hmm. in favor of getting to know Nadine as a human being. Mm-hmm. I like this a lot. And I like it because we don't know right out of the gate that she is, you know, her destiny is to go and be the bride of Flag. Mm-hmm. We don't know that. We have inklings of it. We get hints. We get that creepy scene with the Ouija board, slash whatever that thing is. That's mm-hmm. not a Ouija board. Mm-hmm. But we have gotten to know her and what makes her tick and what drives her in ways that we didn't previously. And of course, miniseries Nadine is basically like, she's like it's like the virgin whore dichotomy. Weird because she's also a virgin, but mm-hmm. Lucy is the mother figure and Lucy is the one that has Joe with her. And Nadine is like the evil temptress mm-hmm. who, you know, wants to rip Larry away from this. Yeah. With the bad wig, you know, use the compelling powers of her wig to pull Larry away from this cohesive family unit. Mm-hmm. She's like a home wrecker. Mm-hmm. And I don't love that choice either.
Yeah.
I mean, so I love that she's good at something. She's good with kids. Yeah. She has a purpose.
She literally I like all that. Is. I mean, she comes to Larry's house and she's like, I need you to have sex with me. You need to save me by having sex yes. with me. But sex to save the friendship? Yes. Yes, that's what we need. And he's like, get out of here. Ooh, what is this? I'm married now. He sells her.
Yeah. Man, that was a reference I was not expecting to get, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then she just goes back to her house and then Flag is there like, all right, go find Harold. This is, yeah. I think, a lot more elegantly done here in the 2020 version or, yeah, I guess I wanted to say 2021, but no, still 2020.
Yeah. I mean, this was all made in, yeah, you're right, Rob. I don't know how we describe this, but, the 2020s
yeah.
anyway.
Yeah. Sure. This one, we'll just go with that.
Yeah, the current day.
Yeah. Yes, I thought it was very interesting, like after that boarding school scene, that when we get she's like looking at the floor and she's not like totally like creeped out. It was like when she sees Nadine, will you be my queen? She's sort of like, I think this is very romantic.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's got to be really, when you are 13 years old, if an older guy makes a pass at you, you might be a little skeeved out, but also kind of intrigued. Mm-hmm. It's like, I have this power. I mean, what if this guy looks like Alexander Skarsgård? Maybe I'm more interested.
Yeah.
I mean, she doesn't know yet. Like, she doesn't know if she's getting Jamie Sheridan or Alexander Skarsgård. It's all very new to her. Mm-hmm. And she's intrigued and she wants to know more. Also, when you're 13, you get that information that you have a purpose. Mm-hmm. I think that's always very powerful as well.
Yeah. Yeah. What was this? This was like a boarding school or an orphanage? What was this set up?
I couldn't tell exactly what this is. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that we will get a little bit more information about it as time goes on and we get to know Nadine a little bit better. But I suspect it is some sort of group home situation, like foster care situation. Mm-hmm. Or it could be one of those like troubled teen camps. Because I noticed that they do have a guard sitting out there, watching over them. It's sort of a psych ward situation or troubled teen rehabilitation center situation. Mm-hmm. Because the other girls had been there before.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like everybody's first night. So that doesn't scream boarding school to me.
Yeah. And they referred to her as new girl, which gave us like a yeah. very troubling new girl, old guy situation with Flag.
Yeah. I guess there's another actor you don't want to see in that role. Like Zooey Deschanel, not good for Nadine.
Yeah. Yeah, she'd be, you know, just too effervescent.
Yep. Yep. Too bubbly. Although, you know, it'd be like, well, we can kind of see it. Like Flag is dark and brooding. Maybe she brings something out of him. Like maybe it's an opposites attract thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not really sure. Another thing I thought was interesting was Flag actually has a sales pitch for her.
Yeah.
And it's not just, I'm Alexander Skarsgård and I'm going to seduce you and it's going to be awesome. He's actually trying to sell her on the idea that Boulder is the bad place and he is the good guy in the good place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he calls Mother Abigail a witch with black magic. And it's kind of like, well, I don't know how anybody buys this because Nadine is the one who's got the like contacting the spirit world device. And, you know, they are literally in a dark place. I mean, how is this something that he can sell with a straight face is what I want to know.
Well, that in the 1994 version, when Nadine has a meetup with Mother Abigail, she's like, I don't like you. You know, we haven't seen Nadine and Mother Abigail. Like, I think that in terms of selling Nadine, that she's a witch. When she goes and sees Mother Abigail, and if Mother Abigail says like, get out of here, you hussy. It's like, yeah, she is a witch. She's so mean to me.
Yeah, she's mean and she knows stuff about me that
yeah, she's
makes
creepy.
Judgments based on. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I get it. She's kind of supernatural. And the supernatural thing, I want to put a pin in that because I want to come back to it. But it is very much like, I don't know how Flag can pull off this I'm a good guy thing. It's like he's got a little button with a happy face on it for sure, but everything else about him just screams bad decision.
Yeah. He's a bad boy.
And some of it is a bad decision in a compelling way. Like, Sure, he is a bad boy. He's good looking, he's charming, and he's scruffy, and you could tell like he's gotten on the wrong side of the law just enough. But it's not like nothing in him says like you could bring this guy home to your parents.
No. Well, I think that's part of the appeal.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's so you can't like if you're going to go that route, you can't say, well, you know, I am fighting for what's good and right and pure and they are the evil ones. Mm-hmm. You can't literally say that. You can imply it. But he was kind of selling that idea a little too hard. For what he is.
Yeah.
What we
know
he is.
Yeah. I guess you could sort of say like, they're a bunch of hypocrites that, they think they know what they're doing. Like, we know better as opposed to like, she's the evil one.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess we've seen enough of this play out where, pretty much anything you can allege, against one particular side of an argument, they just kind of project it back onto you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I've seen enough of that in real life that I can buy it. Yeah. I hear it's a thing that happens.
Okay. Very, very interesting to get all of these different, Flag one-on-one conversations in this episode.
Yeah. You get a lot of Flag. He's kind of more of a, flawed persona than in the previous adaptations where he seems sort of like he is more powerful than everybody, but Flag makes a couple of miscalculations here and he doesn't always know that his decision is going to, you know, come up heads.
Well, can I tell you that's something that's always bothered me about this where, you know, not to totally like, in case people are not super familiar with every single thing that happens in the end game here, you know, we have Flag. He is sort of like this omniscient, all-powerful being. But yeah, he is like kind of easily tripped up by these mere mortals.
Yeah, it's kind of like you could just set a trap for him.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be like Scooby-Doo levels of guile here.
Yeah.
Like just put up a tripwire and he'll fall over.
Yeah, so that in terms of like him being, you know, evil incarnate, I don't know. I don't think they should have been able to stop him.
Yeah, well, here's an interesting thing that I'm clocking, Rob, is that we are really blurring the lines of good and evil in this miniseries.
Yes.
We are replacing a lot of the overt biblical allusions with more magic-y stuff, which David Bloomberg's going to hate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is really not his thing, and I think
if
he hasn't quit it already, he's going to soon. But there's a lot of elements of, I don't think Mother Abigail knew as much about everybody, and she didn't give them this overt plan in the same way that she is now. And the same with Flag, it's like they've kind of slipped it. Like, it seemed like Flag knew a lot about everybody and he knew exactly who was going to be with him and who wasn't. And he didn't really bother trying to pull people over. Mm-hmm. And Nadine was like his one wild card who didn't just immediately blindly accept everything he did.
Yeah. And you're saying that Mother Abigail here in this version of The Stand seems to also have the most agency, where it's almost like that she's playing chess against Flag. And it's like, okay, these are the pieces that I'm selecting to go into my battle.
Right, right. Or it's almost like they're, you know, she and Flag are in the fantasy football draft.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're going, yeah, they're trying to make offers for the same people.
Right. Right. And I don't think that was really a thing that happened. It was just like
National Signing Day.
Yes. Yeah. And I think previously it was like, oh, these people are good and these people are bad. And you don't even think about, like, did anybody, like, what about, did every single one of the, like, thousands of people that end up in Boulder or Vegas, did any of them kind of, did they have both dreams or did they have no dreams? And they're just like, I'm just going to ride this out and see, you know, see where it takes me. Like, I'm just going to find other people. Or did everybody have both dreams, or did some people just have the corn dream and some people just had the flag dream? It's really hard to tell.
And what do you think?
They make it more ambiguous here. I think there's going to be a lot of people that had both dreams and chose freely which one they wanted to go to, because then we run into this dude, like, in the quote unquote present day or the most recent events that we get in this series. We get this guy who escaped from Vegas and came to Boulder, and you don't really get any of that in the novel. You don't get anybody regretting their choice to go to Vegas. It's like everybody either decides they want to, you know, they want to hang out in Boulder with the granola people, or they want to go and party in Vegas.
Usually it's the rule, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Right, right. And everybody stayed in Vegas, except this time they didn't. And this guy, like, rolls up in this very cool car, and apparently Flag tried to kill him and failed, which is also a thing that Flag doesn't do in previous adaptations. Like, Flag wants you dead, you dead. But he runs away, and it's, and Flag kind of plays it off like, no, I sent him here to give you a message.
Yeah.
But that's not immediately clear if that's really what he intended.
Yeah. Well, can we explore that? Because I felt like that my read on it was that, okay, the guy said he got away from Flag, but Flag, you know, of course, did want him to get to Boulder so he could get that message to the people in Boulder.
I mean, maybe it's, I don't know how much this was intentional on Flag's part.
Yeah.
But I think maybe at a certain point he's like, well, I'll just roll with it. And I'll make like I sent the guy over, because it sure sounds like a lot of pageantry.
Yeah.
For, yeah, like I crucified him, then he got down, and then I decided I just let him go. Like, Flag in previous adaptations would just be like, no, that guy's dead, and I'll send some birds or something.
Yeah. And again, you know, I'm not Sun Tzu over here, but I feel like that, you know, for Flag, maybe bad idea to, like, if you are planning on, you know, destroying this group, that he sort of like tells them that he is going to basically destroy them. I'm trying to find in my notes exactly what he says. I'll have your blood in my fist, old mother. I'm gonna blow you away, and you know, you don't need to call your shot on it. You could just do it.
Yeah, like, wouldn't it be better if you didn't tell him and you just showed up and killed him?
Yeah,
this is like Scott Evil talking to his dad.
Yeah, maybe who was it? Seth Green maybe could have been one of the people that Flag could have brought in. Like, what are you doing?
Well, I feel like Seth Green would have chosen the corn. I don't need this aggro. I'm just going to go hang out with Whoopi Goldberg.
Yeah. Why do you have to send them a message? Just kill them. Why are you sending this guy out there in a Lambo? Like, isn't that kind of loud?
Yeah, and also, maybe somebody else wants that car?
That was a nice car waste. Yeah.
Yeah. You're just going to let him take that car? I don't know about that.
I guess that was like the fastest car.
Yeah. I do think there's some interesting differences here, some interesting divergences. We haven't been to Vegas yet. We don't really know what that's like.
Yeah.
And in the 94 miniseries, and I think even to some extent, I think to a lesser extent in the book, Vegas is kind of a pretty chill place to live for the most part. Mm-hmm. Like Flag just goes there and he sets up a society. Like people have jobs and, you know, they live in casinos and they have a good party and they have nice clothes. And it's like, why would he even need to bother Boulder? He's doing a pretty stand up job here. He's not a bad leader. It's sort of like how in Frozen, when Anna leaves Prince Hans in charge, mm-hmm. and he's like going around giving out blankets when it's too cold out. He's like, we have hot soup in the castle. I come in. It's like, oh, you're doing an okay job, man. Mm-hmm. Why don't you just stick with that? You don't need to be evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But here we are getting hints, and this whole scene of this guy escaping doesn't show up anywhere else. This is new to this adaptation, and he just rolls in. And he says, oh, it's a terrible place. And I realized that. I realized how terrible it was. And this guy is awful. He has slaves.
Yeah. And where are they getting slaves from?
Yeah. Where are, you know, how are they? I don't know where these people are coming from. And I don't really know what the guy's impetus was for choosing Vegas in the first mm-hmm. place, because he said he had both dreams.
Well, maybe this is something that you could clean up in terms of like how they deal with it in the novel. But in the 94 miniseries, they're having, you know, their meetings and they're talking about that. They just like very quickly like come to the realization like, hey, Flag's out there, that he could hit us with a Scud missile. He could drop a nuke on us. They're like, boy, you guys have really leapt to conclusions here in terms of like, where are you getting this intel from?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, that Flag has this driving impulse to destroy Boulder. And that's the thing that kind of people cotton onto in Vegas. They're like, well, he's got this whole missile silo that he's working in. He's sending people out to do stuff there. We don't really know what he's doing.
Yeah.
It seems like he might want to kill a bunch of people and he might get a hold of a nuke. And maybe that's not good. Like, maybe we're working for the bad guy. But it takes them like 5 of 6 episodes to realize mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. I just don't know how the people in Boulder figured that out in the miniseries. Yeah. Or it seemed like that they just like realized like, oh, boy, we got to send a spy over there because we don't know what they're working on.
Yeah. Well, I think anytime Flag wanted to get information to them, he'd just like come into somebody's dream.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like that he has a pretty efficient way to be able to send his messages. He doesn't have need to send a guy, a courier.
Yeah. He's not. Yeah. But I guess he's not Freddy Krueger anymore. He can't use mm-hmm. the dreams for anything except a recruitment tool.
Yeah. Perhaps there's like some shield of protection given from Mother Abigail where that he can't really have as much like direct connection with people.
Yeah, I think they kind of imply that at a certain mm-hmm. point.
Yeah.
That Mother Abigail being there kind of insulates them from Flag. But it is mind-bogglingly interesting that people could choose one or the other.
Yeah.
Or they might like, is anybody gonna, like, is this a thing that happens that people leave Boulder and go to Vegas? Because I think we have to talk now. We have to jump ahead and give a few spoilers here. There's going to be a point where they send spies.
Mm-hmm.
And the spies have this cover story that in Boulder, they didn't feel like it was the right thing to do. And, you know, they didn't get along with anybody. They just felt like they wanted more parties and they wanted to, you know, maybe come see a show like, or, you know, what happened to the White Tigers? Are they still there? Mm-hmm. And they roll up and they say, yeah, we got kicked out of Boulder. Can we come live in Vegas? And nobody questions that ever.
Mm-hmm.
But we've never seen any kind of inclination that anybody else had to go to the other place. Mm-hmm. And so I think giving everybody the idea that they can choose one or the other, like maybe some people do choose Vegas after they've been in Boulder for a while. And
boring.
That really gives the spies more of a, it gives the spies more of a cover though.
Although they do talk about here in this version about I'm trying to think of the right, recreational marijuana available in Colorado here in the 2020 version of The Stand.
Yeah, something they could not have done in 1994.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of pot in this episode.
Yeah.
Something we will get to eventually. But mm-hmm. I want to talk about that guy, actually, because this is something that I think is pretty funny. It's somebody who's like a, you know, he's like a E-list or F-list character in the book and somebody who shows up for a few minutes in the miniseries. And he's this guy, his name is Teddy Wyzak. And Rob, I want to see if you remember who plays him in the 94 miniseries.
No, I have no idea.
Because I think it's hilarious. This is the role that Stephen King wrote in for himself.
Oh, okay. He's driving the car with Laura Sangiacomo.
Yeah, and he's like insinuating himself into different things. Like he's driving the snowplow when Stu and Tom come back at the end of the book, or at the end of the miniseries, mm-hmm. and it's like he's kind of a bystander. I mean, sort of like, and then the character that looks a lot like me, Stephen King, is hanging out here, and he says one useful quippy thing, and then he goes back and. Mm-hmm. And I think it's funny that this role is kind of, it's a little bit more prominent now. He's sort of Harold's sidekick.
Yeah, he's Harold's sidekick. He's kind of a weird guy. He was the same guy that was in the premiere that he yes. said that he was going to, he wanted to show Risky Business was the movie.
Yes.
That they thought it would be great to show. He's talking to Harold about how he thinks he has a shot with Nadine.
Yeah, which, no, I don't think in any universe.
And Harold is like really sniffs that out. He's like, listen. And he's not, Harold is not the most realistic person about like who should be with who. And even he's like, what are you talking about? What is wrong with you?
Yeah, I feel like if Harold's telling you that you don't stand a chance, and you know, Harold's the one that's like reading the game and whatnot.
Yeah.
Like, the game was basically made for Harold and maybe mm-hmm. also to some extent Teddy, but Harold read it and Teddy didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that he's sort of this dorky guy that enables Harold to have conversations that get his inner monologue out, which, you know, the novel, as you know, Stephen King is always very rich with inner monologues. So they have to find ways to bring that out. And so they bring in characters so that you have somebody to bounce off of.
Mm-hmm.
11/22/63 did this also. You had so much that was going on in the narrator's head that he didn't really act on. And so they brought in a guy to be his partner in his plans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a device that you really need when you're adapting Stephen King.
Mm-hmm. Jess, could we talk about Nick Andros, who has a big episode here?
Yeah, I would like to talk about Nick Andros, but before we do that, let's take a moment and hear from our sponsors. And we're back. So yes, let's talk about Nick, Rob.
Yeah, Nick, I really liked what they did here overall with Nick. And even though in 1994, I'm sure I thought Rob Lowe was fine, I think I prefer this Nick Andros.
Yeah, what people forget is that this was like Rob Lowe's Pulp Fiction moment. You hadn't seen him for a few years and he'd kind of fallen off the face of the earth. He'd been disgraced because he had a sex tape. And then all of a sudden he comes back in The Stand and everybody thought he was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And now viewed through the lens of 2020/21, boy, he was not very good.
Not great.
That's the material he was given was not great.
Mm-hmm.
And you were right, Rob, when you noted before that they spend a lot of time in the 94 series really treading water and giving you a bunch of information that you really do not need about Nick. I thought they did a really snappy job here mm-hmm. of getting you to the point. Like, they were a little exposition heavy at a certain point, but getting you to the point where you knew everything that you needed to know about Nick. And they did it within a span of about 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did think that it was kind of wild where it was like a Rick Grimes-esque of that he mm-hmm. went to a bar when everything was normal times, got beat up by a guy, and then woke up and the world was over.
Yeah, that was that had to be an homage.
You think so?
I think so. But the weird thing is like, was he really in a coma at an urgent care clinic? That was kind of weird to me. Like he's at City MD mm-hmm. Getting his eye checked out. And was he really out for that entire time and nobody explained to him that, you know, he doesn't have an eye anymore?
Mm-hmm.
I guess like he has to hear that from freaking Flag of all people.
Yeah. And he's not hooked up to any sort of like medical equipment or IV drip or anything. So again, I don't know how long he necessarily survived this week long coma.
Yeah, or maybe he just took an afternoon nap, and when he woke up, everybody was dead.
We don't know. That part was not great. And then also, sort of unexplained, the person who beat him up happened to be brought to the same urgent care. And again, maybe it's a very small town. You know, there's two beds, okay? There's one for this guy that got beat up, and then one for the town bully who ends up beating up Nick Andros, that he is in the hospital bed across from him.
You know, they had to do the thing where they want to portray Nick as somebody who will be compassionate even to his enemies, which mm-hmm. they do by having him work in the jail for some reason.
This was still better than him working in the jail.
Yeah, this was way better than him working in the jail. It does seem like a pretty big coincidence that the last guy left alive in the city MD is the guy that put him in the coma. That is a little suspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little sus. In the 94 miniseries that he ends up, getting into another confrontation with the same guy and ends up killing mm-hmm. him. He does not need to do that here.
No, he doesn't. Captain Trips takes care of it for him.
Yeah.
Thank you, Captain. But it did give him the chance to show that he's not going to seek vengeance for this beating that he sustained, and he's not going to let the guy die. He's going to stay there and like help him feel better, because he's not the guy that Flag thinks he is. Yeah. And here is the most interesting Flag moment, I think, of the whole series so far, that Flag is not a great judge of character.
Mm-hmm.
He basically offers Nick Lloyd's job before he offers it to Lloyd. I mean, how sad is it that Lloyd is second choice? That's mm-hmm. got to be upsetting. I hope he doesn't find that out. Or maybe he does find that out at some point. But it sure seems like he got the pitch from both Mother Abigail and Flag. And Flag was like, I want this guy for my team. And Mother Abigail's like, oh, no, you don't. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take him because I need a wide receiver. And, you know, you got my quarterback. This is really an interesting conversation, and I kind of hate that it's just like a way to drop all the information out. It's like Flag's like, I know everything about you. Mm-hmm. You know, your mother was an illegal immigrant, and you've never been able to prove your worth, and I'm going to prove your worth, and I'm going to make you here again, and I'm going to give you back your eye. And Nick's like, what do you mean giving back my eye? I've got my eyes. He's like, oh, you'll find out.
Mm-hmm.
It was really exposition-y. And granted, I don't need to see 30 minutes of Nick working in a jail, mm-hmm. but there's got to be a more elegant way to do that.
Yeah. I did like the stuff with the cards, the way that, you know, it's a little on the nose, you got dealt a bad hand, and I did like the juxtaposition of the Jack with the eye patch, and then ultimately him having the eye patch. So I thought that was cool. It just does not seem like in any way, shape, or form that Nick Andros would be a fit for working for Flag.
Right.
Does not seem like his kind of guy.
Right. And I it's weird that Flag got that so wrong. It's weird that Flag even tried.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, I don't even know. Like, I feel like there's another sports analogy with drafting people in here, but it's like, why did you even put that contract in front of him? He's never going to sign it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's like some sort of maybe like a love triangle where it's like, do you think that I'm your type? Why would you think I would be up for this?
Yeah. Although this is a really interesting way to underline the dichotomy between Flag and Mother Abigail, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, the writers are showing a lot more knowledge of what it is like to be deaf.
Yeah.
Where I don't think Stephen King ever thought about what that really would be like. And I certainly don't think the writers of the miniseries did. Because the choices, like the perks that come with each of these jobs.
Yeah.
Flag says, well, when you come work for me, you can hear again and you get your eye back and you'll be able to talk. Yeah, I know you've never been able to do that. I bet that's something you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Mother Abigail says, I will give you an important job. You will be my voice, and I'll show you what that means.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean a literal voice. It means a figurative, important role, and you'll be doing good. Mm-hmm. It's like the corporate job or the nonprofit.
Yeah.
And there's knowledge about what it's like to be deaf that's really helpful here, because I think most people that have been deaf from birth would not necessarily say mm-hmm. that they want to hear perfectly and speak perfectly.
Yeah.
Like their lives are fine. They don't need that. And it's a big miscalculation on Flag's part to say, hey, I'm going to fix you because there's something wrong with you. Mother yeah. Abigail says, there's nothing wrong with you. In fact, I need you to do this for me.
This is actually something that I, from my time playing Survivor with Christy Smith, that she had talked about how, like, in the deaf community, like, there are, you know, even like between people of, you know, having hearing aids versus not having hearing aids is, you know, can be like a controversy of like trying to, you know, just communicate via sign language or also trying to communicate more via speech. You know, people have different feelings about that. And just going back to like a conversation that we were having about the actor Henry Zaga, I know that there was some controversy about, you know, him being selected for playing this part. I actually think that this is an incredibly difficult part to play because that you have to like go through like this, even more so here than what Rob Lowe did in 1994, that he's signing, he's deaf in the regular times, but there's often parts in the dream sequences where he has to talk and sort of like go back and forth between, you know, having the disability and not having the disability. So I thought he does a really good job with it. Again, this is not my area of expertise to be able to determine, but I thought he really nailed it.
Yeah, I am pleasantly surprised at his interpretation of the role. Given the choices that the director has made in how they are going to portray this, because I think there would have been a path forward to giving us Nick played by a deaf actor, but I see now why they didn't make that choice with the material that they have come out with, mm-hmm. because Nick spends a lot more time being able to speak and hear.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the 94 miniseries, I think he does hear Mother Abigail and he does speak to her. And then there's the scene at the end where Tom has a dream where Nick shows him mm-hmm. where to get the medicine for Stu. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, if we were just doing a straight readaptation of that, you could do that differently. You could find a way to make that happen and be able to bring in someone who is actually deaf to play the role.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more of that in this. And I think it's going to be a recurring motif. I think I would not be surprised to get at least one more moment apart from the one we know is coming.
Yeah. Jess, what do you think about the creative decision to have him lose the eye and give him the eye patch? Because I feel like that of the three iterations, novel 94 in here, this is the only one in which Nick has the eye patch, right?
That's right. I don't believe that is a thing in the novel. I know it is obviously nothing happens to Rob Lowe's beautiful face in the 94 adaptation.
Rob Lowe with an eye patch, I do think, would be a hilarious sight to see.
Well,
I do not think he could pull it off.
Doesn't he have one in Austin Powers?
Oh, yeah. Wow. The Austin Powers trilogy is yeah, oh, because he's the young number two.
Yes, he's the young number two. And I believe he does have an eye patch.
Is that also the one with Heather Graham? Yeah.
Yes. See, it all comes full circle. Mm-hmm. Everything is connected to Austin Powers.
Will there be a third Austin Powers alumni?
Who do you think it's going to be, Rob? Like, who would you like to see in this adaptation?
Yeah. I'd have to take a look at the cast list. Let's see. We've talked about Seth Green already.
Yeah, I want to see Seth Green, actually.
Yeah, could Elizabeth Hurley make an appearance?
Yeah, it's possible. I wonder, this is probably too small time for Beyonce.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, of course, she shows up as the love interest in the third Austin Powers film, Goldmember.
Yes. Yes, and like then I think we've gone through now every single role that is played by anybody other than Mike Myers. So that was a short, trip.
Frau Farbibsna, yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah.
R.I.P. Vern Troyer, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Will Ferrell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, all right, Nick Andros is here, and you know, it's Mother Abigail only will talk to him. Is this new?
That's somewhat new. I mean, he was always kind of her right-hand man, but I think the idea that she's only going to talk to him and he's going to be her messenger is downplayed in the previous adaptations, to be sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Mother Abigail is like, she's a little more cantankerous in this iteration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they're bringing her in like, hey, Mother Abigail, come check this out. I feel like that she did not really, leave her house much in the previous iterations.
She's like, I'm 108. Are you really going to make me walk all the way down here to the hospital?
Mm-hmm.
Seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. We're more of like a Whoopi Goldberg, like Guinan of can we get you to Guinan? Come talk to this Borg. Check out what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've been saying all along. She's like Guinan in a white wig, which she was a little bit less this time. I feel mm-hmm. like I'm starting to get to know who she is, but we really have not seen very much Mother Abigail up to this point. And I think what there is of Mother Abigail has been used very judiciously. Like, I don't think they want to overload us with her the way that they did with Ruby Dee's Mother Abigail.
Yeah.
So we got to meet Tom Cullen. That was another thing that we'd all been looking forward to.
What did you think about new Tom Cullen?
I think I like him. I like him a lot. I think this is a much more, just as I think Henry Zaga's Nick Andros is much more attuned to the actual experiences of a deaf person. I think they gave more than 3 seconds thought to what it would mean to be a developmentally disabled person in this universe. And they mm-hmm. gave him a little bit more of a backstory, which I did appreciate.
Now, in terms of, I do believe this is the novel N94 miniseries. The meetup between Nick Andros and Tom Cullen comes from that he's part of, he lives in a small town that everybody else has succumbed to the virus, that he is like putting mannequins all over the place to sort of like recreate the feeling of the small town. Nick runs into him. It is not that Tom has been given instructions from Mother Abigail to go seek out Nick.
That's right. And I want to know what you think of this, Rob, because this goes back to our previous point where Mother Abigail is giving a lot more direction this time mm-hmm. around. And does this make more sense to you?
I think it, I don't know how I feel yet about this. I feel like that I don't love the idea of like everybody just found each other. It was all a big coincidence that it all happened. So I guess if we're going to go down the path of that, okay, no, all of this was planned, then I think I do like the fact that they're, running into each other with like, okay, find this person, as opposed to it was, just happenstance that they all just happened to bump into each other along the way.
Yeah, I'm going to also, we're going to come back to this when we talk a little bit about the connection to Glenn. But yeah, I think this is much more elegant. Like, if some of it's going to be planned, why don't we just plan that as well? And mm-hmm. that gives us a little more of a sense of why is it these people? Because you didn't get that in the previous ones. It was like, these just happened to be the people it happened to. It was all random and coincidental. And when they ran into each other, something magical happened. But this is great. And it also gives Tom something to do.
Yeah.
It's like, he's not just hanging out waiting to be discovered. He is a man of action and he can do things, mm-hmm. which he really didn't get that sense in the previous iterations of Tom had him. Like, he basically just lived with his mom until she died. Yeah. And then he went and played with mannequins until somebody came and got him.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, again, this speaks to they at least like thought about what do developmentally disabled men in 2020, what would their lives be like?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, he has a job. He can communicate with people. He knows, he's self-aware in as so far as he can be. And his caretakers have given him a spiel to give to people mm-hmm. when he first meets them.
Yeah.
And I thought I have so much sentimental love for the 94 miniseries, but yeah. I buy Brad William Henke's performance here much more than I do Dauber's.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd say that because that was one of my absolute favorite portrayals in the 94 miniseries, but this is a much more sensitive and nuanced Tom Cullen, and I'm here for that.
Tom Cullen has a Dolly Parton t-shirt on.
Love that, too. Like, Dolly Parton is...
M-O-O-N. That spells Dolly Parton.
Yeah. I mean, really, Rob G. Otis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rob G. Otis of the 2020 Best of Grant Steele.
Yes. Yes.
I'm sure he voted for her for fan favorite.
Certainly. Not the Among Us imposter.
Yeah. And I think this is also something that you would see somebody wearing... much more, you would be much more likely to run across somebody wearing that than bib overalls with no shirt.
Yeah,
I think people did wear that at one point in time in certain parts of the country, but I don't think we could get away with it now.
Yeah. Okay. So we have Tom Cullen. I thought, you know, it was a really good scene where he shows up, and I like, he's like, oh, well, sorry about your friend.
Yeah. I don't, there's one thing I don't understand. Why Nick can't get across any point because he can't write things down.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't he playing Pictionary?
Ooh, charades. Yeah.
Yeah. Because he's trying to play charades and Tom is not getting it. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, your head hurts. Like, what's wrong with your eye? What are you pointing to? I don't understand. There's a bunch of hair in front of your ear. Yeah. So you can't possibly be pointing to your ear. Why doesn't he just draw a picture of an ear with an X through it?
Hmm. Yeah,
it sure seems like there are ways he can get his point across.
Yeah. How much paper does Nick Andros have? He's like a very specific, like he doesn't seem to be carrying around like legal pads with him.
Also, it's 2020. He could have an iPad. It could speak for him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Maybe didn't think of that.
Yeah.
Nobody showed him that feature.
You know, if Larry can be using GPS to navigate through the sewers of New York City, I feel like Nick could find an iPad.
Mm-hmm.
Or even he's in a clinic. They carry whiteboards everywhere. There's whiteboards, like every medical facility in the United States is lousy with whiteboards.
Yes.
Get a whiteboard. You don't have to worry about killing trees.
Well, in fairness to Nick, he just woke up from a coma.
Yeah, I think maybe they'll sort that out.
He hasn't,
but it doesn't seem like he does.
Gone through the whole
doesn't
place,
seem like he ever does.
Inventory.
Yeah. He's got his like little tiny notepad and he just carries that around with him. Like just carry
also,
a man purse and put a whiteboard in it.
Nick,
come on.
Also, maybe like get a Sharpie also, you know, that, you know, I got to get like super close here and read your, you know, little post-it. Come on.
Yeah. It's almost like, what are you doing? Like gouging it into the floor? Because
mm-hmm.
guess what? I couldn't read most of that message either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jess, can we talk about Greg Kinnear?
Yeah, we have to talk about Greg Kinnear because this is a weird choice.
Okay. It was a weird choice that I did like the performance. Is Greg Kinnear uncredited in this role?
No, I think he's credited. I mean, he's in IMDb.
Yeah.
This was actually the first casting choice that I had heard about.
Hmm.
And it was the one where it really made me scratch my head.
Yeah.
And I've been kind of throwing this, you know,
oh, yeah,
comparing.
He's all the way. He's all the way down.
Yeah. Well, he's not in it. He misses out on two whole episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And he really is like, he does take a back seat, which that character always did.
Yeah.
But he is played, of course, in the 94 miniseries by Ray Walston.
Yeah.
Who, best known for being my favorite Martian in the 60s.
Right.
Ray Walston was like in his 80s when he played this role. And so I was like, Greg Kinnear is not that old.
He's not that old. And so I guess settle this for us. In the novel, is this character supposed to be old?
This is a funny thing, Rob. He is supposed to be old, but Stephen King writes him as being 57 years old. And here's what I think happened. Stephen King was writing this book in his late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And to him, somebody who's 57 years old is positively ancient, but mm-hmm. he can't be so old that he can't like make the trek at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I'm just going to write him as old as I can possibly think of somebody. Just make him like 57. That's a long way off. Mm-hmm. 57 is really super old. That's what we're going to do here. And So I think that's what happened, because the character as he is written in the book really is an old man, and he kind of talks like an old man, and he pontificates like an old professor type. He's not Gale Bettiger from Breaking Bad.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I feel like, how Greg Kinnear is playing him. Greg Kinnear, who is in his mid-50s, playing a man in his mid-50s.
Mm-hmm.
And still, the dialogue that he is given is that of an 80-year-old man. Mm-hmm. So, it's very weird.
Yeah.
And
Did you like it?
Also, I like it. I like him. I do think it kind of changes the dynamic with him and Stu, because I think he was more of a father figure to Stu when they meet up. And here it's like two middle-aged white guys having dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's weird, too. And like talking about it like, oh, yeah, I'm widowed, too. It's, you know, I lost my wife. Oh, yeah, I lost my wife, too. And it's a weird, weird thing that like you don't really get a sense of like these are people that would never have met in anything but extraordinary circumstances. But it's also I don't really get the sense of like what makes them that different. Like you can see where they find common ground, but if the people making the stand are supposed to be such incredibly disparate personalities and individuals, not getting enough of that from Greg Kinnear at this point.
Yeah, that's interesting. Their big disagreement comes from where Stu is like, hey, we got to get society back up and running. And
yep.
Greg Kinnear's like, no, what's wrong with up and running's the problem. We need the down and staying still. And I felt, you know, like this would be me, I think, during the stands. It's like, well, why do we have to get started again? Why do we have to start a society? This is fine.
Yeah, what's the hurry?
What's the hurry? I'm
maybe,
here. We're
maybe
painting.
See what this is like.
Yeah. My dog is here. I got a generator. We have no food shortage. I thought that Stu seemed like he liked the caviar. I feel like that it should have been probably a little bit more like Tom Hanks in Big trying out the caviar.
Well, maybe Tom Hanks' problem is that he didn't put it on a potato chip.
Mm, yeah. Who doesn't like potato chips?
Yeah. I mean, I personally have never had caviar on a potato chip. I might like it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's salty and salty, though. That seems like a lot of salt.
Yeah.
Don't know about that.
No, you're asking the wrong guy.
I think you were expecting, like, I think that was a conscious choice on their part. Like, they want him to like the caviar because they expect him. They expect the viewers to think he's going to have the Tom Hanks reaction. And then when he doesn't, it's like, oh, he contains multitudes.
Yeah. He's a fancy
That's
man.
That's really
Stu.
Stupid. Yep. Stu is secretly a fancy man. He's more complicated than you think. We need to talk before we get a little bit further down the road of Stu and Glenn. We have the first scene that we see Stu this episode. He meets Fran and Harold on the road and he doesn't go with them. And I think that's an interesting choice as well.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know when they meet up again.
Do you think they'll reconnect before Boulder?
That's hard to say. I honestly don't know. And I think at this point, nobody knows they're going to Boulder, which is the other crazy thing about this, the way this story is being told. So it's kind of like, probably we'll never see these people again in my life. And so maybe somewhere on the road when they meet up again, because nobody knows where they're going. Like they talk about, well, I'm heading this way. Well, I think I'm heading to Atlanta. Cool. Have fun. Have a good trip.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think they're ever going to run into each other again. So I can see them being on the road and encountering each other again and be like, oh, I thought you were going to Atlanta. Oh, I thought you were going to California. And then being like, that's their moment of connection. And they realize that something extraordinary is at work and that they need to come together.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where it's going.
Yeah. Yeah,
but
it was a cool scene. I like that that meetup, and of course that we know that Harold is no fan of Stu from the jump, and it seems like that Stu and Franny have like a little bit of chemistry there, and but then they end up going their separate ways. Interesting.
Yeah. It is interesting,
but we do get some clarification though, where. I don't know if I'm jumping around too much to talk about Franny's baby.
Yes, we do get that point of clarification that I think both you and David were puzzled by this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, is this Stu's baby? And it's very clearly not Stu in that photograph.
Yeah. Yeah, this is like out of Lost, where we are getting like the sonogram. Am I using the right terminology?
Ultrasound. Yeah, I think they're the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I had like 8 of them, mm-hmm. but I don't really know what the official term is.
Who is the woman that is performing? Were they both veterinarians? The woman doing the ultrasound and then the other person?
Unclear.
Yeah.
And this is also a departure from the book in the best of ways, because there was one medical doctor in Boulder in the original novel, and he was another old white guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also in the miniseries, old white guy. But there is a lot made of the idea that for a long time, the only guy they've got who's medical at all is a veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a running joke that he has to work on different mammals.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but then this doctor shows up later, and then they have an actual doctor in time to deliver the baby.
Yeah.
So I think they're just kind of yada-yaing that and moving an actual doctor in, but also making the nod to the veterinarian.
Mm-hmm. Shout out to Herschel also.
Yes. Shout out to Herschel. Which, you know, The Walking Dead borrows a lot from The Stand.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things I think they borrowed.
You know, I have to say, I'm not quite ready to be back into The Stand universe, because every time they're going to some like new place, I'm like, oh, be careful, walkers. Like, oh, wait, no, yes. There's no zombies in this. I forgot.
Rob, do you think that the existence of Walking Dead kind of takes away some of the spookiness of the universe of The Stand?
It seems so peaceful with no zombies.
Yeah. I mean, you get Glenn's point.
Yeah.
It's kind of quiet. Kind of nice.
Yeah. Like, it seems like very relaxing, the world of The Stand.
Yeah. I think the miniseries makes a point to... The 94 miniseries is like, oh, well, in a world where everyone's dead, you could drive a cool car if you want. Mm-hmm. And well, everybody's got clean clothes all the time because you can just take them out of people's closets. And you know, there's dead people around, but we can get rid of them and move into their houses. And it's a very nice house.
Mm-hmm.
So I think at least we're not doing a lot of that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But the appeal of a very quiet world, I think it's a little bit. On the other hand, we've been living in a very quiet world for the past 9 months. So
yeah, I want to say that it's kind of the opposite. It's sort of like the world of the 2020 and 21 so far is like, don't leave your house. Don't leave your house. Stay. Whereas like the Stand universe is like, hey, world is your oyster. You go out there, like have at it.
Yeah, that's true. It's like, get as far from your home as you can. Like, take a trip.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, your loved ones are gone in the Stand universe, but mm-hmm. nobody is too particularly broken up about anybody they've lost along the way. Like, you know, you see Franny crying about her dad one time, but there's mm-hmm. almost like nobody ever in the course of the Stand is like, boy, you know, I really miss my significant other.
It's true. And it was something I think Stephen King deliberately writes his protagonists to be people that were sort of loners already.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that sort of, he has that sort of quasi-libertarian thing that he did, especially in his earlier novels, where his protagonist was somebody that didn't have a lot of friends and kept to himself a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the same way that all of his protagonists now are writers with a traumatic event in their past.
Yeah. Is Stephen King married?
Yes. He's been married to the same woman since the early 70s.
Okay.
And it's a great love story.
Oh.
But it does seem like he's not somebody that was like Mr. Popularity growing up.
Yeah. I mean,
it's been a while since I've read his memoir, but
yeah.
But he always writes his characters. And I think he just identifies with them a little bit more as the sort of the outcasts. And it plays to good effect in The Stand, because you have all these people that feel like they're nobody special and have been told that they're nobody special, and they're selected for a special purpose.
Mm hmm.
So Stu is somebody like, you know, his wife died and he's closed off from the world. And Glenn is obviously like super jazzed that everybody's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And Larry is so messed up that he doesn't have real relationships. And Nick has been thrown away his whole life. it brings together these people purposely to find the community in each other, but they're not going to be as upset about everybody in the world dying because they don't really have people anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is a shortcoming of this story that you never get into people being truly upset, like, by all of this death.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we even got a pretty big taste of it this year, and it was like a very tiny fraction.
Right.
Like, and it was still just overwhelmingly sad and upsetting. And it's like everybody died and nobody's upset about that. And that doesn't ring true to me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Having got a tiny taste of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe something in the next iteration of The Stand that they could work into it a little bit better.
Yeah. And I think the next iteration of The Stand is going to be a little bit more informed by how does the government behave in an actual pandemic?
Mm-hmm.
Because we talked about this already, where they were trying to pretend that nothing was happening. But here we couldn't pretend that nothing was happening and the information was getting out, and they had to, you know, local governments had to lock people down, and they had to admit that something was out there and you knew about it before it ever hit you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different thing in this information age.
Mm-hmm.
That I think the show did an okay job of modernizing it.
Yeah.
But there's still a lot of things that we haven't really, that they didn't really get right. And, some things that they got frighteningly right.
Yeah. We've been new now.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. So I want to talk about, Glenn's art, because
yeah.
this is something, I think this is a plot hole that the miniseries has fixed.
Yes.
And Rob, I've heard you say it, conversations that nobody wants to have with anybody else.
Mm.
You don't want to hear about people's survivor ORGs. You don't want to hear about their Brant Steels, and you don't want to hear about their dreams.
Fantasy football teams also.
Oh, yeah. Fantasy football. Sorry. We just spent the whole hour talking about fantasy football. So, yeah. Nobody wants to talk about their dreams. And if you meet a new person, especially if they are the first person you've met in like a month,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to get off on the wrong foot by telling them about the weird dream you had.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something I feel like the story always got very wrong, because they just all sort of the first thing out of their mouths is like, hi, nice to meet you. I'm having a dream about a lady in cornfield. I'm going to go. You want to come with me? And this, they have to work it in a little more organically. And I think they're doing a much better job of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because Mother Abigail gives them very explicit directions, or they find out some other way that somebody's having the same dream.
Mm-hmm.
And it does kind of make it a little messier at first, because people aren't all going the same direction. They're not going to meet up on the road in the same way. But I liked this idea that Glenn is painting what he's seeing in his dreams, and then Stu recognizes scenes from the paintings. And that's their kind of entry point into, oh, this might be real and we might need to follow it.
Right.
Because I think, Rob, how many times have you had a dream and then you did what your dream told you to do?
Probably zero. And I also would like to add in, is Glenn too good of a painter?
Yeah, I think part of his character in previous adaptations was he was a shitty painter.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I just do it for fun, and I might be the best living artist now. Yeah, he's pretty good. I mean, he's
right.
Was he a professor, or did he work as a sketch artist for the police department?
Yeah. Did he go into like courtrooms and like do like the dramatizations?
Yes.
He's an art professor.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I think he's got enough of the identifying details that mm-hmm. he probably could have. Like, I think he could have had a painting of Mother Abigail, and it's like, oh, it's an old lady with white dreadlocks and corn.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I had a dream about that, too. That was pretty good.
I'm with you. I think they could have done Mother Abigail, like, oh, the lady in the corn. Yes, yes. Okay. But then we go to you've obviously painted Franny Goldsmith. I ran into her the other day.
Yeah.
I felt like that maybe that one was like a little bit too detailed.
Yeah, that sort of beggared belief.
Like, does he have a photographic memory? Like, even if you had like a photo of Franny Goldsmith and then said, paint this, it would be an amazing feat if you were able to replicate that. Not only that, if he did it from memory.
Yeah, well, unless Mother Abigail is like forcing his hand and he was a very bad painter, but now she has imbued him with superior artistic gifts.
So he's like Nadine with the planchette with the paintbrush.
Yes. Like maybe she's working through him and she's like, I need someone to paint my official portrait. I will have Glenn do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to have it like commissioned Hemingway home.
Yes. Hemingford home. Hemingway home is where the six-toed cats are.
I watched this show a couple hours ago. I can't give you that from memory, but Glenn could dream of Fran Goldsmith and then paint it from memory.
Right. And also, are they just going to leave those paintings there? Or do they have to now bring them with them? Because it's like, Fran might like to have that. That's a nice picture of her. Yeah. Like Mother Abigail, like, why'd she do all that work in getting him to paint the portrait if she doesn't want to keep it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're just going to keep it at his house? I don't know, man.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Rob, is there anything else that you want to call out?
We didn't talk about Larry and the kid. Yeah.
Well, we got to hear Baby, Can You Dig Your Man?
Yeah, I got a little bit of that. And again, I do like the like stripped down version of it. So that's pretty good. Joe is a guitar prodigy.
Yes. Also something that I don't think they did it in the 94 miniseries, but it is in the book, that he just picks up the guitar and starts playing it perfectly and then won't part with the guitar after that. I wonder now, what are they going to do with Joe?
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't seem like they're giving him that like supernatural aversion to anybody. He tries to kill Larry in the first scene, which he does also in the book. But what is Joe's ultimate purpose going to be? And also, where's Joe going to go once Nadine pieces out?
Yeah. I mean, will Nadine leave Joe?
Yeah, that's because, you know, she leaves him in good hands when she takes off in the previous adaptations. Like she says, well, you can go stay with Lucy in the book because she doesn't really have much involvement with him in the 94 miniseries.
Yeah. I don't think she ever meets him.
Yeah, this makes her much more complicated as well, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Because what's she going to do? She already said she's going to be his mom.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that there is going to have to be a choice for her where, you know, do I leave the kid to go to Flag?
Well, now I don't love this, Rob, because I feel like it's now making her choose between like motherhood and her sensual, like romantic self.
Mm-hmm. Well, does it change anything if the sensual romantic self is with the Lord of Darkness?
It's a good question, Rob. Mm-hmm. I don't know. He's pretty sexy. Yeah, like you could see the appeal when she goes into the trance and meets him. It's like, oh, yeah, I get why she's into this.
There's chemistry.
Yeah, there's chemistry there. And she was kind of like 94. Nadine was a little bit afraid of him and she's like, yeah, I don't know about this mullet. You might have to cut that before I'm going to get on bed with this. And then he turns into the evil red demon. And he's like, no, you're going to do it with me. She's like, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's no chemistry there.
Yeah.
This is like, you get why, like if she's been having dreams about this her whole life, you can get why she's thinking about going there now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it'll be interesting how this version of the show is going to treat the Nadine Harold relationship, which I would imagine we're going to get in the next episode.
Yeah. It looks like the pieces have been put in place for that.
Yeah. Now, again, just this is also still very interesting just in terms of like timing wise, because I feel like that if we were into the 94 miniseries, I kind of feel like that we're sort of like at the end of the third night of the fourth miniseries here at this point. I know that there's going to be other stuff that we're going to still have other character introductions to do, but we still have, you know, 2/3 of this 2020 version of the show to go. And I think that we're going to like have, you know, a lot more of this story that we're going to get.
Yeah, I would imagine we're going to get some pieces fleshed out that we haven't seen before. And also the, like, just looking ahead to some of the characters we haven't really met yet and we haven't had much interaction with. Mm-hmm. I have to think we're going to get at least a couple more episodes like this, where it's just like we're meeting people on the road and getting like their deal before they were, you know, before the end times, and then like kind of folding them into the bigger group that we've already met. Mm-hmm. But I actually, one of our listeners theorized that after the, you know, after the midpoint, they might just dispense with this nonlinear storytelling altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's possible.
Because, you know, it is really a story told in two halves.
Mm-hmm.
So I could certainly see the reasoning for doing that. But who do you think we're going to get next week?
Well, I think who's left? Trash Can Man?
Yep. There's Trash Can Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think over on the good people side, we still have to meet. We've seen Ray in the background, but we haven't really met her yet.
Yeah. I mean, is there anybody else that's a particularly impactful character?
I guess not. I think we've got almost all the players on stage at this point. Mm-hmm. But one interesting thing that I clocked is there's a character, a very peripheral character in the Vegas crew that you see in the miniseries very briefly, has like a couple of snarky lines, and that's about it. And it's this guy called the Rat Man.
Oh, yeah, the Rat Man.
Yeah, you remember the Rat Man, right?
Yeah, Rat Man, he goes third person on you.
Yeah. And they have gender swapped this character as well.
Oh.
And so it's now a rat lady. I wonder if it's like a Zardulu situation or what her deal is.
Yeah. Looking forward to the rat lady.
Yeah. So I wonder if we're getting some rat lady action next week, because it's a weird choice to continue to include this character. When there's really, you don't get that much of him in Vegas, and it's like you could write that character out entirely and nothing would change.
I think they just need to fill out the roster on the flag side of things.
Yeah. And you know, we're still like, if they need to bring in a new person from each side every week, we must get Trash Can Man and Ray next week. And mm-hmm. then I'm not sure who else we have on our side. We also haven't met Julie Lowry, and I think she is credited as appearing in this, but I don't know how that's going to fold in. Mm-hmm. Rob, do you remember her at all?
Not particularly.
She is met on the road by Nick and Tom.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah, no, she's very mean. She wants to like seduce Nick, and then she's not a nice person.
Right. And then she ends up, of course, she ends up in Vegas. Like, you know, if she had the corn dream and the Vegas dream, she definitely chooses Vegas every time. And then when Tom is sent over as a spy to Vegas, she recognizes him.
Mm, got it.
So it looks like she's going to play some role. So I bet we get that scene next week.
Maybe. Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah, I would imagine we get like the second half of the Nick Tom journey.
Yeah.
Like they meet Julie and then they meet Ray, and Ray drives in the rest of the way.
Yeah. Jess, can we talk about the closing credits for The Stand? Because I feel like that these have been very interesting.
Yeah, I noticed that too this week. And have they been different every week?
I think they have. I think that they have been like a lot of like the featured objects that are in the episode mm-hmm. end up in the closing credits. We talked about last week that it was the song Brand New Key, which really did match up with the episode. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the selection of the music that was over the credits, which and you are the music expert on the podcast way more than me. What's the name of this song? It's Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, it's Go Ask Alice.
Ask Alice. Okay.
Or is Go Ask Alice just the name of the? Here, I'm going to look this up.
Yeah, I tried to look it up, and I thought that's what it was.
Yeah, it is. It is Go Ask Alice by Jefferson Airplane. White Rabbit is the name of the song.
Okay,
Go Ask Alice is the movie that takes the title from the song. White Rabbit is the name of that song, and it is like a 1960s like
very psychedelic. Kind of,
psychedelic song. But it really sort of underlines this duality that everybody is experiencing and this free choice that they're all making. Like the one pill makes you larger, one pill makes you small. it really kind of reminded me of like everybody's having both dreams and they're picking which one they want.
Yeah. A little bit of like a matrix of like which pill do you want from the flag or Mother Abigail?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think anybody's ever had to choose a pill up until mm-hmm. now.
Yeah. So I just was curious as to why they closed, because the episode closes on Harold and his buddy dropping off the bodies. And they talk about how it's a fresh body. And Harold says it's the first of many. And I don't know if we've had like a time jump at all where I don't know why he says that here.
Well, it is actually several months into it. We know it's about 5 months since they got there.
Yeah.
Because we can track that by looking at Franny's belly. Mm-hmm. And I think Harold at this point is like he's been fully rejected by Franny. Probably doesn't even talk to her anymore.
Probably.
And we saw him having the homicidal impulses at the end of the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's already thinking like that. He's like, I'm going to make everybody pay for the fact that this girl I wanted doesn't want anything to do with
it. Okay. So, but he has not necessarily like met up with Nadine yet.
Yeah, he may or may not have met up with Nadine. It's hard to tell. Also, it's interesting, like the matrix that you bring up the matrix, because you know that Harold definitely hung out on the Red Pill subreddit.
Yeah. He also probably watched the alternate office closing scene, right?
Yes. Yes, he definitely did.
Yeah. But the closing credits have been really cool. Very much have enjoyed them.
Yeah, I think some of the elements have been recycled. I think it's like everybody has like a desktop with some of their stuff on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like whoever was featured in this episode, we get to see like their assortment of stuff, like mm-hmm. their collage.
Yeah.
Because I think the Harold one was in the first episode. But now I want to go back and watch them all and see if that's true.
Yeah.
Because I know there were new objects that we had never seen before, like the cards in this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would like to go back and watch the first couple episodes of this. I feel like that it probably is rewarding to watch it a second time.
Yeah. And Rob, do you think that might be even more true if you're coming into this not knowing anything about it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you learn more, you sort of like want to go back and like, oh, that was that guy.
Yeah. So maybe I'm starting to see a point to all of this where I was not fully sold on it. Even last episode, I'm starting to see where this could be your introduction if you felt like you were the kind of person that wants to go back and immediately rewatch things.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's a little bit freeing to be able to tell the story in this way, because if you I guess you could do limited versions of flashbacks where you could do sort of like the origin story of Nadine potentially after we've already met her along the way. But I think that for the creator, I think it is very freeing to be able to just do whatever you want.
Yeah. And it's also, this is on streaming, Rob. In 1994, you could not get away with this. Because this was on and then everybody forgot about it. And you didn't catch it the night it was on and you didn't have your VCR set. You were never going to watch it. Mm-hmm. So you had to tell that story in a linear way that made sense so that people that came back the next week, they would remember everything that happened the previous time and could jump right in again. And now I didn't watch it the second it dropped. You know, I watched it in three pieces this morning. And on different devices, and I could go back and watch it again whenever I want.
Mm-hmm.
So it does lend itself well to diving deeper and going back and rewatching pieces. It's very easy to go back and be like, okay, I want to go see the credits again and see what I missed.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows you to tell a different, deeper story.
Yeah.
So I'm getting it. I understand what they intended.
We're in.
Still in on this, Rob. Do you think, barring a total radio silence from the listeners, do you think you'll be back on this next week?
We'll see. We'll see. Look, don't take it for granted. Okay.
I know you got a lot going on. You're watching Kid Nation, and you could just go back. Like you could do an extra Kid Nation podcast.
I think that I could probably do a interesting comparison between the society set up in Boulder, the society set up in Las Vegas, and the society set up in Bonanza City, and let you know who had the most effective government.
That's a good point, Rob. And I think we would certainly have some interesting comparisons to draw. Like, obviously, Taylor is going to be the flag of this universe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so I like it.
There will be some comparisons. Of course, probably Bonanza City and the Las Vegas have a similar climate.
Yeah. I mean, it's a desert world that leads itself, you know, it lends itself well to anarchy. But on a related note, Rob, it's interesting. There are children in this version of the stand and it's talked about, whereas there was like two children in the novel and the 94 series. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, oh, there's enough children that they've got somebody tasked with. Yeah, there's a school.
Yeah.
And also the line about, I just want to give them a taste of normalcy. I'm like, oh, that hits a little hard.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's enough kids to like fill out a whole kid nation in this iteration of the stand, which I find really interesting. And I wonder if they'll 40? Go back. I don't know if there's 40. There might be enough to like create one team.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll see exactly what the syllabus is that Nadine has planned.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's like a whole, like, maybe they're going to help her build the bomb.
Yeah. That would be wild.
That would be pretty wild.
Yeah.
So, Rob, what else is going on for you?
We've got everything that's going on over on Rob's podcast. You mentioned Kid Nation. We're going to kick off our top 40 season rankings journey, our trek from Bangor, Maine to Nebraska. Is that where Harold and Franny are coming from?
It's like near Bangor. Yeah. It's like a small town.
So,
but
yeah, we're taking the long road to get there. And so we're going to kick things off this week talking about the worst Survivor season ever.
I can't wait to find out what that is, Rob. Mm-hmm. I have ideas, but
yeah.
You know,
your guess is probably right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know what I ranked my worst.
Yeah.
It's probably the same one everybody did.
And then we're ripping off the Band-Aid and getting it out of the way. And then next week, we'll talk about the second worst season of Survivor.
Boy, it's just going to be like a long succession of Band-Aids. It's like your whole body is covered in Band-Aids or like, I don't know. Or is this like your eye got gouged out and then the next one is like, you have a split lip and it just goes on until you have like a tiny paper cut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll see. We'll see what it's like. I won't be able to tell you until we're there, but very excited about all that.
All right. Well, good stuff. There's a lot more going on over here on Post Show Recaps. We are dropping something every day this week, even though it's a holiday. And same thing next week as well. We are going to be talking, Mike Bloom and I have plans tomorrow to talk about episode 12 of season 3 of Star Trek Discovery. We got two more episodes left, like this one we're talking about tomorrow, and then the finale is next week, and then we're just going to hang out in space and wait for another Star Trek to drop on us. We also have on Everything is Super, Josh and Kevin are going to be talking about the Wonder Woman movies, including Wonder Woman 1984, which they'll be talking about this week. Haven't seen it yet. Heard it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Don't really know.
Yeah.
Did you see it yet, Rob?
I have not. I have heard mixed things.
Yeah. It's hard to say. People said there's a lot of fun things to love about it. Mm-hmm. And then people said that it was a disappointment. So we'll just have to see what they have to say about it.
What do you want from Wonder Woman 3?
Yeah. Is it Wonder Woman 3?
I have no idea.
Did I miss a Wonder Woman in there?
I think that she was in Justice League and the other one. I have no idea. She's a very busy lady.
Yep. She's got a lot going on. And so do we, actually. There's going to be a very special edition of our podcast, Aang, in there, which is our rewatch of Avatar The Last Airbender. So Josh Wigler and Kevin Mahadeo will be joining Zach and Jake to talk about the M. Night Shyamalan live action adaptation of Avatar, which, speaking of great disappointments, I think they're going to have a lot to say about that.
There was an M. Night Shyamalan live action version of that? What was the format?
Famously, one of the worst movies ever made. Like, everybody who likes Avatar The Last Airbender hates this movie with the Fire of a Thousand Suns.
Yes. What's it called?
I think it's just called Avatar. The Last Airbender.
That movie.
Yeah. Not the one with the blue people.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm going to look this up because now I need to remember what it's called. Maybe it's called something else, but,
it's not The Lady in the Water, is it?
No, it's just called The Last Airbender. No, Lady of the Water is something different. But yeah, I feel like Shyamalan, it's sometimes I'm kind of amazed that he still works after he did stuff like this.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's some name actors in this. Dev Patel was in this.
All right. 2010.
Yeah, but everybody hates this. I've never seen it, but I've heard it's really bad.
All right. Vaguely.
So I guess we'll find out. And I wanted to take one more minute to thank all the patrons of Post Show Recaps and invite people that are not yet patrons to look into it. Because when you support Post Show Recaps on Patreon.com, your pledge helps us keep things going here, keeps the lights on, opens the door for us to recap more shows in the future, potentially. Stuff like this, Rob, like us just deciding that we're going to do The Stand, that's made possible by the patrons. But when you become a patron, there's something in it for you as well, because you also get access to special content. We do 3 extra podcasts per week, a weekly newsletter that I personally write. And access, I think this is the biggest one that people are talking about as being the biggest perk and kind of the unexpected perk, is access to a community of like-minded TV fans over in our patron Discord channel.
People love it.
Which is a very special place. Yeah, people love it. And at the $15 level, you get special post-show recap swag like a Wombat's hat. So to learn more about patron perks, to sign up now, visit postshowrecaps.com/patron or patreon.com/postshowrecaps. So I super appreciate all of that. And of course, I appreciate you if you're a patron, but I appreciate you as well if you're a listener. And Rob, I appreciate you for coming here and looking through all of this foolishness with me, because I didn't think that there would be anybody that would allow me to geek out about The Stand on a deep level.
Well, I'm so glad that we have been doing this, because I'm having so much fun with the series and talking with you. And look, even if nobody else is enjoying it, I don't know. I'm not going to take it for granted. We're having fun, okay?
Yeah, we're having a great time. And we would love to hear from you if you're also having a great time. Like, shoot us a Twitter or give us a comment on postshowrecaps.com. We want to know, how you're taking this. Like, do you agree with us? Are our takes fresh? Are our takes bad? I will tell you, Rob, I went over into the Reddit for The Stand.
They don't like it.
They hate it. And everything that they say that they like about it is stuff we hate. And everything that we like is stuff
that they
hate.
What's the stuff that we hate that they like?
We said, I could tell you some things off the top of my head that we liked that they didn't.
Yeah.
And some of them are like writing Rita into the series and the portrayal of Rita. This was after the second episode. We were pretty high on Heather Graham. And they're like, why is Heather Graham here? Rita needs to be a dowdy middle-aged woman. And, you know, or maybe just write her out entirely. And why are they, the big one was, why did they write out the thing with the tunnel? And it's like, because it doesn't make any logical sense. I don't know. So, if our takes are bad, you might find a more fun time over at the Reddit. But otherwise, stick around with us. We're having a good time.
Yeah.
We're amusing ourselves, even if we're not amusing anyone else. But I think reception on this has been great so far.
Yeah.
And
we
super appreciate it. The more that people interact with us, the more likely we are to continue doing it. Right, Rob?
That's right.
So tentatively,
we like positive reinforcement.
Positive reinforcement is what keeps our engines running. That's what keeps the world spinning, even in a time of crisis.
That's right.
Yeah. So tentatively, Rob, will I see you back here next week?
Yes.
Okay. And so
write it in Ouija board pencil.
Yeah. I'll get my Ouija board pencil and carve it into the floor.
Yeah.
So I think that about wraps it up for us then, Rob. If the stars align and we have the right dream about it, we'll see you all here next week. Thanks for listening.